Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent. This week on the HR Power Hour, we're bringing back a great guest. Her name is Anne-Marie Story, and she's an employment attorney with Rudman & Winchell. And we're going to be talking today about criminal issues in the workplace. They're in the news. They're happening now. So let's talk about it. Anne-Marie, welcome to the show again.
Thank you for having me.
You know, this topic, as we have talked about offline, is something that is getting a lot of activity in the news today. And there's a lot of real questions as to guidance that is coming out from the EEOC as to what people think they can do, what they can't do, what they should do, what the guidance is versus what the practicality is. There's a lot of things that are happening right now with these new EEOC updates having to do with criminal background checks and criminal background information. I'm setting the stage because obviously I went to a recent discussion here at a recent HR SHRM meeting locally here in Portland, Maine. And we had a gentleman from the EEOC come in and he talked about some of the things that they're recommending. For example, no longer asking about criminal background having to do with application or having to do with anything, even if it's a sensitive position. What's your take on all this place, all these things that are going on with this today?
Well, you know, the EEOC said back in 2012 in their guidance that they were recommending employers not ask about arrests or convictions on applications, but then they sort of took a line that was a little bit more gray than that and said, well, you certainly can't ask about arrests, but you can ask about convictions if they are job-related and consistent with business necessity. As I understand their position, the reason they're saying not to ask about arrest is because it's their contention that a disproportionate number of minorities are arrested but not convicted. And so denial of a job to somebody based solely on an arrest could potentially be a disparate treatment. And I agree, is unfair because there could be a lot of reasons why someone would be arrested but not convicted. It could be the wrong person. It could be,
Sure,
you know,
absolutely.
That makes sense to me.
Yep.
The convictions, though, I think is different. And I know that, they have taken this hard line. But I will point out that there was actually a recent court decision where the EEOC took this position and argued against an employer having asked about convictions. And the court said that their position was not supported. And part of the reason for that was because the employer was able to demonstrate that they only asked about time-limited convictions, and they limited them to ones that could potentially impact the person's ability to do that job. So, for instance, if it was a job that required driving, it was okay to ask about convictions for OUI and things like that. And I think the same is true of safety-sensitive positions. But the other thing the court said that I thought was very interesting was that the quote-unquote expert offered by the EEOC to support its position about a disparate impact on minorities with convictions was not convincing. And in fact, the court pointed out that the EEOC itself does criminal background checks on its hires. So, there's that.
Oh, that's beautiful.
So my view of this issue is that employers should be should be able to without the EEOC saying that it's discriminatory, as long as it's done in an even-handed manner, to ask about convictions and consider those that are job-related and consistent with business necessity. And so while I certainly do not advise my clients to just randomly exclude people because there was a conviction of some kind, 30 years ago, I think it's information that bears consideration. And part of the reason I say that is because there is a cause of action for negligent hire and negligent retention. And part of the way someone can make that claim against an employer is to say, well, you should have known that this person you were hiring had the propensity to whatever they did, steal or beat me up or, you know, have an OUI or whatever the case might be that caused the injury. And if the employer has not done a background check, the employer's going to have a hard time defending that claim.
You know, I think this was, again, in the conversation that the EEOC gentleman had here in Portland, I think that one of the things he brought up was this whole question of liability, right? And so he couldn't answer the question, and actually he kind of skirted the issue, to be honest with you. But he did seem to take the stand that, well, you know, if a potential employee for your organization or applicant comes in, that they should be given equal treatment and you shouldn't be asking questions up front, just like you wouldn't ask medical questions or anything else. And I just see a difference between the two in terms of liability for the organization and for the employer.
Well, I think that's true, but I often advise my clients to not do the criminal background check, and in fact probably other parts of the background check, until they've made a conditional hire. Partly because it's just far too burdensome to try and do that on every applicant. And then if you don't do it on every applicant, but and you pick and choose instead without a conditional hire, then I think you are, in fact, at risk of a claim being made that you did the picking and choosing based on some kind of consideration that you shouldn't have made. So in other words, I only did criminal checks on women or on a certain minority. And so my advice generally is I wouldn't go to that extra step until a conditional job offer was made. Then you do the criminal check then and a credit check if the position merits it, because that's restricted, I think, as well.
So you're saying that, you know, if we're talking about doing background checks, and I want to talk about informal background checks in a second, but I'm just talking about, you know, formal background checks at this particular point. You're recommending they be done after somebody gets a conditional offer of employment rather than before the conditional offer of employment, even if they've signed a release form saying it's okay?
I think so. I mean, just from a practical standpoint, if you know that this is the person that you want to hire, you make the offer contingent on a satisfactory. And I think you have to be careful about that, because it's not – I don't think you want to say, you know, a clear background check or conviction check or whatever you want to call it, because, again, there could be something in their history that you choose to disregard. But I think it's on a background check that's satisfactory to the employer. I mean, I think you could do them before that, but I guess in my mind, I'm not sure that it's worth the effort, frankly, because, like I said, you can't pick and choose among applicants. So if you're going to do it before a conditional offer is made, and you're going to do it on one applicant, then you really need to do the same thing for everybody, and that can be just, as a practical matter, not even possible.
Well, I know some organizations may say, well, we're going to get it down to our top two, and then at that point, we're going to make that, you know, do the background check on it, kind of like we might do assessments or other things and take a look at it in terms of, you know, what this person is like. And I guess it also depends on the position, correct? If you're talking about, and I'll just use some examples, if you're talking about a bank teller, or you're talking about a position that's going to handle sensitive secrets of an organization, or you're talking about someone who handles a lot of money, a lot of cash, that might be a very big deciding factor in terms of background checks.
Absolutely. And like I said, if you don't do it, and you're hiring somebody who handles somebody else's money or works with people that are at risk somehow, either young children or elderly or the infirm or, you know, something like that, and the employee ends up causing injury to those people, then you're even at increased risk for negligent hire and who knows what else. So
we're talking about a formal background check. How about informal things? And so let's go through a couple examples. One might be a sex offender list. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, I know that there are certainly employers, I mean, and again, part of this depends on the context of the position, because if I have four applicants for a position, I might handle this totally differently than if I had 150. But if I get it down to a reasonable number, you know, it's easy now to run those names even as a Google search or a, you know, whatever other search engine is out there. The sex offender registry, the, you know, I'm looking for YouTube videos or Facebook pages. And I think a lot of, well, more and more employers, I think, are doing those things. I don't see any reason why not to search public information as long as you are consistent in the way you do it. So, again, if you have two applicants that you're very interested in, then you do the same search on both of them, I think that's fine. If you have 150, you know, it doesn't really make sense, and you certainly don't want to pick and choose, like I said. But as long as the information is available to the public, and so I, you know, I want to be really clear that I don't, employers cannot try to access private Facebook pages or pretend to friend somebody when they're not really, or however that, you know, however that works. But I think the public information is out there, and it's, you know, for the taking.
Now, would you recommend that the hiring manager not do that and that somebody else be insulated? I've heard a lot of legal advice has come out that has said basically have it not be the hiring manager who is checking it, maybe HR or someone who's, you know, once removed from that hiring, and that they should not be the one that actually looks this information up. What's your take on that?
Well, I certainly have seen that argument made, and the basis for it is that it is possible that you will see information that you're not supposed to have at this pre-hire stage. And that's another reason, you know, why it might be a good idea to wait until after a job offer, a conditional job offer has been made. But if you're doing it at the pre-offer stage, I agree, there is a good chance that if you look up somebody on a search engine, you're going to find out, you could find out medical information, you know, who knows what that you're not supposed to have. And so the theory has been that an employer have somebody designated to search those names and then provide the hiring people, whether it's HR or the hiring manager, whoever it is, only with information that they are permitted to have and exclude anything else so that the decision isn't tainted.
Okay, so we've talked a little bit about here what we would call the informal background check. We've talked a little bit about the formal background check. So to wrap up this a little bit so that, you know, obviously the listeners have a clear understanding, what is the recommendation you're giving to, you know, organizations in terms of how they should handle this? How do we wrap this up in the background area?
Overall, my recommendation is that a criminal background check should be done on any post-offer conditional job hire, and I'm suggesting that for almost any job you're hiring for, whereas it used to be only for sensitive positions. Because the information is so easy to get and because not having it could put the employer in a bad position, I think it should be done. And then I don't think somebody should be excluded no matter what. I think individual consideration has to be given to the results.
Okay, great. So I'm gonna continue with this discussion about an applicant first, and talk about other types of things such as polygraph tests. There are organizations that feel that they're appropriate at times, and I actually tell the story many years ago when I went to work for a drugstore chain. We won't identify them here on the air today. I went to work in Massachusetts for the drugstore chain, and they polygraph tested everyone in management. This was back in the 90s. Actually, it would be the late 80s. And so you can't polygraph test, at least at that time in Massachusetts. And so they sent me to New Hampshire for one day. They hired me in New Hampshire for one day and then transferred me to Massachusetts and took care of the problem, as they like to say, which made me laugh. But it's okay, and clearly I passed because I went to work for them. And I might add, it's kind of weird being wired up in the back of a break room to have that done. But anyways, we won't get into the logistics of it all. What's your take on an applicant in regards to polygraph testing?
Well, there's a Maine law that addresses this, and it specifically says that for an applicant, the employer cannot require, request, or suggest that an applicant submit to a polygraph as a condition of the employment or administer the polygraph or have somebody else administer it or use the results of a polygraph in a hiring setting. So it's out, basically.
Okay, so they cannot do it for any type of hiring of an applicant. Can they do as I suggest, hire them somewhere else where it is legal and then bring them in?
I would not recommend that.
I figured you wouldn't. And I'm sure you're going to ask me during the break, who was that?
But I'm
going to
say no to that.
Okay, well, you know, I thought I'd ask the question in terms of it. Okay, so just to continue on the polygraph for 1 second, if you're an employee, can an employer do that?
Well, the same rules apply to an employee, and of course the exception is law enforcement agencies, but the same rules generally apply, except that Maine says that an employee can voluntarily request a polygraph. So if they're accused of something in the workplace, they could request that the employer do a polygraph, but the law then goes on to say that the results cannot be used against the employee for any purpose. So one has to wonder what the point would be.
Absolutely. That makes
makes a lot
of sense.
I mean, I would not recommend doing it because I think if you can't use the results to take adverse action against the employee, the only thing it would be good for is to try to solidify the employee's position.
Let's be real. This is having typically to do with theft, right? I mean, that's the number one area that you see an organization wanting to think about a polygraph test if there's a large amount of money maybe missing or, you know, something in that type of area. I could see somebody, or as you said, maybe law enforcement should be involved at that point, and then that
right.
changes the game, doesn't it?
Exactly.
Yep. It does in terms of it. Okay. All right. That makes perfect sense. We're talking with Anne-Marie Story. She's a employment attorney at Rudman & Winchell, and we will be right back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB.
They say it's never too late to be what you might have been. So if you want to turn your passion into your profession, AARP can help you find new opportunities that take advantage of Work Reimagined, a program that leverages the power of LinkedIn. AARP also provides access to tools, resources, and information that can help you at every step. Just a few of the ways AARP helps turn your goals and dreams into real possibilities.
AARP, real possibilities.
Go to aarp.org/possibilities to find tools and guidance.
Real Possibilities is a trademark of AARP.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour, presented by CMAcareer.com. And today we are talking with Anne-Marie Story. She's an employment attorney with Rudman & Winchell. And she's back as a guest on the HR Power Hour today. Again, Anne-Marie, thanks for being back.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, the first half we talked a lot about, you know, having to do with background checks and different things having to do with this criminal issues in the workplace. I think I'd like to get a little bit into things that sometimes happen, though we don't like to talk about it very much. And I know that, you know, whenever we talk with companies or organizations, there is this feeling like it's not going to happen here, it's not going to happen to us, but it does happen periodically, and that's violence in the workplace. First of all, I guess the question is, there are preventative stages that companies should be thinking about, having to do with policies, having to do with maybe even training, different things that they're thinking about. What's your take on violence in the workplace and how an organization should start to think about it or put some systems in place? Because, hey, it could happen.
It certainly could. And I think, you know, every employer who has a handbook ought to include in that handbook a policy about, you know, no violence in the workplace. It can be as broad or, you know, as focused as the employer wants it to. But I think it's worthwhile to take a position and just say we don't tolerate it. We're not going to tolerate it. I mean, a lot of what you hear about now is bullying that's short of violence. And, of course, there's not as much an employer can do about that, but they certainly do not and should not tolerate any form of violent behavior. And in fact, I think a lot of employers don't realize that if that does happen in the workplace, there's a very good chance that it could be covered by workers' compensation, and the employee can make a claim for it.
That's probably news to some organizations out there. So explain how that whole thing would work, just so that, you know, somebody who's listening going, why would that be covered when it really, I mean, how was I supposed to know?
Well, the Maine Supreme Court has actually addressed this issue several times and held that any workplace injury that arises out of and in the course of employment is work-related, and that is true of intentional acts and also violent acts. So there are a lot of examples in Maine of cases where there have been assaults in the workplace, or even going so far as rape and similar crimes. And as long as there's a connection to the work, then they have been found to be work-related.
Okay, so an individual comes in and something happens. Okay, maybe it's a fight that escalates. Maybe it's something in the workplace. When you're saying violence, because I want to help a little definition here. What is the definition of what somebody would be considering violence? Because is it pushing, shoving? I mean, I just want to kind of have somebody give an idea of what that would mean from a legal perspective.
Well, I think it would mean something different for a general policy against it versus a workers' compensation issue. I mean, in a workers' comp issue, you've got to actually have an injury. So if somebody shoves somebody and that's the extent of it and there's no physical or mental injury that results from it, then there likely wouldn't be any workers' compensation issue. But that same behavior ought to be inappropriate and not permitted under an employer's general policy against workplace violence. Because don't forget, in addition to potentially being covered under workers' comp, you know, OSHA's general duty clause requires an employer to provide a safe workplace. And so any of that kind of behavior, even if it doesn't result in an injury, could potentially violate that general duty clause.
So,
not to mention it's just inappropriate.
Right. No, it is inappropriate. So obviously the recommendation is there should be something in the handbook, something in the policies that prohibits violence in the workplace. We would recommend, as I'm sure you would, some sort of training for supervisors as to how to handle it and what to do from that point, correct?
Yeah, I think that should be part of the larger training for supervisors that includes, you know, the harassment training, and it just seems to flow directly from that kind of issue.
In 2011, there was a change here in Maine, and it is in some other states, that an employee is permitted to, with a valid permit, to keep a weapon concealed in a vehicle. The car has to be locked. The weapon cannot be visible. It basically has to be it could be an employer's parking lot. Tell me your take on this and how this affects employers.
Well, unfortunately, there's not much discretion by an employer. I mean, the law is clear that as an employee who has a valid license to have that weapon can have it in their vehicle parked on the employer's property as long as the vehicle is locked and the weapon is concealed. Now, interestingly, the law went on to say that an employer is immune from any damages that result from the firearm being there, including theft, but it does not affect workers' compensation. So if somebody were to go out and get their own weapon, bring it into the workplace and use it, then resulting injuries could be covered under workers' comp. And that would be true even if somebody other than the owner of the weapon. So if a coworker went out, broke into the vehicle, brought the weapon back in, and used it, it would still likely be workers' compensation.
Does an employer have the right, and I know the answer, but I thought I'd just make sure that we're all clear here on the air today, does an employer have a right to ask what employees have that permit, see validity of that permit, and know if they're keeping a weapon in their vehicle, in the car?
I think they do have that right, but it's a much more important question, I think, to ask why would you ask that information? And a lot of people have a different opinion about this. My feeling is, I'm not sure you want to go there, because what good would it do for you to know that the weapon is in the vehicle? And if you know about it, does that then give you some kind of heightened duty toward anybody? So, for instance, if you know that a certain individual has a weapon and you see that person lose their temper and go running out of the building, do you then have some kind of heightened responsibility to be sure that they don't you know, then do something. I mean, I don't know the answers to those, and I don't think anybody does. But my view is, unless it's brought to the employer's attention because the weapon is not concealed, or, you know, the vehicle's not properly locked, or there's some issue about violation of the law's provisions, I don't think they ought to go there.
If an employer has a policy that says it's okay to carry concealed in the workplace, and they made the decision that for some reason that is okay for safety, and I'm aware of some actually, is that something that is legal? Can they allow such a thing if they? I mean, obviously it is. The question is, what's your take on that? I guess wow would be the answer to the question.
Wow, I don't see any circumstance under which that seems like a good idea to me. I just don't even know why you would choose to allow somebody to bring in a concealed weapon into your workplace.
I can certainly tell you that in one instance, one organization is in a very rough neighborhood, and there is no parking where they are, and they have to walk about two blocks, and it's not the safest place at night, and they work late. So that's one of the reasons they allow an employee to do that, to protect themselves.
Well, I guess my hope would be, if that's the case, they're, and now I'm just, this is just sort of off the top of my head, because I have not had an employer do this before, but provide perhaps a locked area in the workplace where it could be kept while the employee is on work time, so that somebody's not walking around with a concealed weapon during their work hours.
Okay. So we've been talking a little bit about workers' compensation claims having to do with workplace violence. What does an employer need to consider if an act should occur? What are some of the issues to consider in this area?
Well, the primary one, of course, is whether or not the behavior arose out of and in the course of the employment, and that would always be the first question to ask. And in coming to that answer, you would want to think about things like what caused the violent act. So, for instance, there's a case where an employee got into a physical fight with his supervisor over an issue of pay. He thought that he had been docked pay inappropriately, and so the basis of the violence was because of something work-related. But there are cases where, for instance, the behavior is based on, let's say two coworkers have a relationship outside of the work area and get into a fight at work, but the reason is because of something that happened away from work and doesn't have anything to do with work, then I think you have a good basis to argue that that would not be work-related. So that's the first consideration, is what is it that caused the violent behavior? I think the other thing employers always want to think about is, can this be characterized as horseplay? Because there is an exclusion in Maine's Workers' Compensation Act for horseplay, but employers have to be very careful about that, because the court has been pretty clear in interpreting this provision to say that if behavior has occurred before and the employer is aware that this kind of behavior is occurring, then it's not going to be excluded as horseplay. And so an example of that is if you have two employees who regularly get into minor altercations, you know, hit each other casually, have that kind of relationship, and the employer knows about it and doesn't do anything, and then they do the same kind of behavior and it results in an injury, then it's less likely that that's going to be excluded as horseplay because the employer was aware of it and let it happen.
Okay, got that. So, you know, one of the things that sometimes comes up with violence in the workplace or maybe compensation is domestic violence. Tell me a little about how that plays into either the workers' comp part of it or even into, you know, violence in the workplace?
Well, again, you know, if it's going to be workers' compensation, it's got to be, it's got to arise out of and in the course of employment. And so there's only one case in Maine that I'm aware of that's been decided by the law court, and that was many, many, many years ago. And in that case, the employee worked as a receptionist for the employer and was assaulted by her significant other, who did not work for the employer but came into the workplace to have access to her, because that's the only place he could get to her. And there were a variety of other things going on. For instance, the employer had told her that she had to talk to him when he would repeatedly call because it was becoming so disruptive. And so after the assault, she made a claim for workers' comp, saying that the employer, by forcing her to deal with the situation, basically put her in a situation of being harmed. And the court said, no, that was not enough of a connection to work. So I think if the violence comes into the workplace just because the employee happens to work there, that's not necessarily going to be enough. But if an employer employs both of the spouses, for instance, and the domestic violence then results at work, then there may be more of a potential of it being covered.
We're talking with Anne Marie Story. She's an employment attorney with Rudman & Winchell in Bangor, Maine. We're having a great discussion about criminal issues in the workplace. And we will be right back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB.
You might hear some advice from your friends on choosing a health plan. Darling, you must choose the gold healthcare plan. Not the silver plan. Too much trouble. Do they have a stainless steel plan? I like bronze, like my tan. Are sunburns covered? Instead, take advice from a licensed agent from Northern Insurance Group. Meet face-to-face with a local healthcare exchange professional. Call Northern Insurance Group today. We have the resources to make sure you make the right choice.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB. And we are talking with Anne Marie Story, employment attorney at Rudman & Winchell. And we're talking about criminal issues in the workplace. Anne Marie, so we've talked a lot about different things today, but one of the things that I'd like to dig a little deeper in is, what do we do if somebody actually does steal? What if there is a potential theft at a workplace? And it could be cash, it could be intellectual property, it could be office supplies, it could be computer equipment, it could be almost anything. What are some of the things that you're seeing in terms of what an employer should do at that particular point in time?
Well, I'm going to concentrate on private employers because, of course, there would be different rules for public, but you know, most private employers with at-will employees have to approach these situations, I think, in much the same way they do claims of harassment. I mean, a lot of times it's a matter of doing an investigation and then reaching the best conclusion that you can reach based on, the evidence and the information that you can gather. What's different about these situations, though, is that at some point it may be necessary to involve law enforcement. And I think the really hard question for employers, and there is no right answer to this, is how do you know whether to do that and then when to do it? Because you certainly would not want to impede any potential criminal investigation. But on the other hand, you know, if you jump the gun and call the police, you could be facing defamation claims or who knows what. So I think that's been a real difficult issue for a lot of employers I've worked with on these kinds of claims. And just to throw another element in there, to the extent the employer needs to and wants to notify an insurance carrier of a potential loss, it's been my experience that most carriers will require a report to the police. And there may be reasons why an employer does not want to have the police involved. It may be public relations issues, and they don't want this, you know, made public. So those are just among a lot of issues to consider. And then, of course, you get into surveillance and what an employer is permitted to do and invasion of privacy claims about accessing employees' computers and other information at work and cameras. And so there are a whole lot of elements to consider here.
So let's talk about that. Let's talk about the surveillance end at this point. So, and we can, let's break this down a little bit into different areas. So let's first start with, you know, in the workplace itself. So in other words, in an office setting, in a factory setting, in the building itself, forget about cars or phones or any of those other things. what can an employer do if they want to put surveillance in a workplace?
I think a private employer is permitted to put surveillance in any areas that are understood to be public. And so I would not advise that it be put in places like bathrooms and things like that. But in public areas, an employer can have surveillance if they choose to do that. My experience with this, though, is that it can make as much a difference to let the employees know that the cameras are there than it does to have them hidden. So, in other words, just by putting the cameras up and saying we are going to have surveillance in these areas can be as much, if not more, of a deterrent than putting in secret cameras and then, using them that way.
If you have an issue or a concern or you think somebody is doing something and you decide to put them in and do that in a hidden way, do you first need a policy for that? Do you first need, how do you prepare yourself, or can just a private employer go in and do it and that's the way it is and then, deal with the ramifications at that point?
In terms of cameras of public areas, I think an employer can just do it. I think you would want to approach other situations differently. And so, for instance, a private employer would have the ability to search through any employee's computer, but I think they would not want to do that without having a policy in place ahead of time, making it very clear that the computer and whatever other electronic devices, phones and BlackBerries and all those things that we all use, are the property of the employer, that everything in them is the property of the employer, and that the employer can access it whenever and however they choose to, so that the employee is very clear that there's no invasion of privacy.
Because I just want to make sure we're covering everything, how does this change if it is a public employee's area?
Well, a public employer is going to have coverage under, the unreasonable search and seizure amendments. And so there are going to be more limitations on what a public employer can do than a private employer.
So let's talk about phones for a second specifically. A lot of employers are just simply paying to allow the employee to use their own phone, having their personal phone, and giving a stipend or giving some sort of, paying for the plan for their data and their phone, or maybe partially paying for their phone. How is it different if it's a company phone, in other words, provided from the organization, this is our phone, versus sharing of a phone?
Well, I got to tell you, I'm not a fan of employers having employees use their personal phones for work business, and that is for a variety of different reasons, including this one, because I think employers want to be able to have full access to whatever the employee is doing on the telephone, and if the employee is using their own phone, then I think the employer is much more limited in what they're able to access. I think they should still have a policy, and it should still say that anything you do on the phone that has any relation to work is subject to our review. And so if they were to go through and review cell phone records, for instance, they could still look at the entries that are work-related, but they would have to sort of step back from personal calls. And so there's much more of a gray area there, and I think it's harder to administer. The other reason I say that doesn't have anything to do with surveillance or theft, but it's about work hours. And because it's easier for an employer to control or review an employee's work history and the amount of time they're spending working when they're using employer-provided equipment. Because the last thing you want to do, of course, is have an employee who is non-exempt working additional hours and then not being paid for them and later having an overtime claim.
All right, so we're talking about phones, and we've certainly this I assume would also apply to iPads or
right.
other computers that are out there, that laptops or other things like that as well.
Yes, I think that's true.
All right, so cars, vehicles, and I'll break it down into two pieces again. So a company car, company truck, company vehicle versus private car used for company time, because obviously Most companies are not going to pay for an employee to have a car unless it's for some reason. So let's break that down. Let's start with company vehicles.
Well, I think an employer has the ability to do some things with a company vehicle they don't have on a private vehicle, and one of those things may very well be tracking by GPS, for instance. Because if the car has a built-in GPS tracker, the employer can have a policy that says when you're in a company vehicle, we may or we do operate the GPS tracker, and they can follow exactly where and what the employee does. Whereas with a private vehicle, you're not going to be able to do that.
Is it recommended that a policy is produced that spells out exactly what would happen if it's not a company vehicle and what the rights are of the employer to ensure that the vehicle is, let's say, clients are taken in it sometimes, to make sure that the condition of the vehicle is good, to make sure that the perception of the company's view of how they're perceived, you know, having to take a client to make sure that the car's clean, to make sure that the interior is clean and that it presents in the right way, just like you would an office. What's your take on that?
Well, I think you do, but that, you know, just sort of serves to illustrate how much less control an employer is going to have over a personal vehicle. Because not only do you want standards of cleanliness if you've got clients or customers in the vehicle, but you need to ensure safety standards as well. And so you can have a policy that says, you know, the car has to be safety inspected or whatever it is you're going to say. But again, you have much less control over that than if it's a company vehicle that's coming back to you every night, you know, that can be assessed by your own managers or whoever controls that sort of thing.
So I'm going to take the car thing one step further. Does an employer have the right to verify driver's license records, have a right to verify that the license is still valid? Does the employer have the right to ask for insurance, copies of insurance, if it's an employee that has to drive for company use?
I would say yes to all of those things if driving is part of that person's job. And in addition to those things, I think an employer would want to also say, if there are any changes to the status in your driver's license, so if you get points for speeding or, you know, suspension or anything like that, even if it's off work hours, I think the employer is entitled to know that.
What if the employee doesn't provide that information? Can discipline, including termination, be done at that point?
I would say yes, as long as it makes a difference to the job. So if driving is not part of the job, then of course no, but if it's a person who drives as part of the job and you have a policy saying you need to do this and then you find out the employee doesn't, then I think disciplinary steps could certainly be taken.
Maine doesn't have a specific law that prohibits a private employer from disciplining or terminating an employee for off-duty conduct. We're talking about someone who obviously is not necessarily working on the clock at that point. How do you handle a situation where the employee maybe gets a DUI or gets arrested or something happens, they're in the wrong place at the wrong time, and it could have an impact on the business from maybe they're in the news and something happens. Tell me your how you would perceive that from a legal standpoint for an employer.
Yeah, again, this is one of those real gray area kind of questions because it depends entirely on the fact situation. I mean, I think generally it's worthwhile for an employer to have a policy that says it may be that there is off-duty conduct that could impact your employment, but you have to be very careful about what it is and what you do with it, because there is off-duty activity that's entirely legal that an employer can't take any action against. So, for instance, if an employee smokes outside of the workplace, I mean, just regular cigarettes, outside of the workplace and doesn't violate any of the employer's smoking policies in the workplace, you couldn't turn around and say, well, we don't want anybody who smokes to work here, because there's a law that protects those people. So you have to be careful about what kind of off-duty conduct you're talking about. And then, of course, you know, as most people have seen, because it's all over the news, the NLRB has been very vocal within the last several years about employee conduct that is protected activity. And so an employer can't just say, well, you can't say bad things about me when you're not here, and you can't talk about your wages and all those kinds of things, because they're prohibited from doing that by the NLRB, and that's true even of non-union employers. But if you get an employee who has an OUI or an arrest for something else, then I think you really have to take it as a case-by-case basis, because, you know, first of all, you go back to the fact that the EEOC says you can't rely on arrests for anything, so you have to factor that in.
Right.
But it may be as simple as the employee is no longer able to be at the job, and so it becomes a performance issue as opposed to, a policy or a morality issue for any other reason.
We're speaking with Anne-Marie Story, employment attorney at Rudman & Winchell. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB, and we will be right back.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis, as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour, and our great guest today, Anne-Marie Story, employment attorney at Rudman & Winchell. We've been talking about criminal issues in the workplace. Anne-Marie, it's funny, we were just finishing up the last segment, and you said, smoking. And then, of course, you kiddingly just said, well, I am talking about cigarettes. And that kind of worked into the next question having to do with issues, and that would be medical marijuana in the workplace. This is an issue that's certainly going state to state. There's 21 states out there currently, and it looks like it's going to be passing in a few more very shortly. And let's be real, probably in around 2016, it could probably be recreationally used or legal here in Maine. What's your take on the Medical Marijuana Act and how employers should deal with that?
I think it's important to know what the act does not permit, and what it does not permit is for an employee to use or be under the influence of even medical marijuana while they're at work or on work time. So even if they are an authorized user under the act, the employer cannot discriminate against them on that basis, but the employer also does not have to permit or allow the employee to either ingest the marijuana or use it in any other manner while on work time, or to report to work under the influence of it. And, of course, that begs the question of how do you ever tell whether somebody's actually under the influence or not. But for theoretical purposes, that's what the Act says.
And certainly, I think employers need to think about what they are doing in terms of their policies having to do with what does under the influence really mean, and how supervisors are trained to figure out what that really means in the workplace. One of the other things, and I want to kind of wrap it up here as we're heading into the final stages, because I think this is a very important topic. Can an employer, and I know the answer, by the way, employer withhold things from a person's final wages if, for example, they don't give their keys back, they owe money on a debt, if the employer is out there, if they don't give back a book or they don't give back their computer? How does that work?
Generally, the answer is no. An employer cannot withhold any final owed pay for failing to return keys or uniforms or laptops even, or anything like that. The only exception is if the employee has a loan or a debt to the employer. But the law is very specific that debt does not include things like inventory shortages, damages to the employer's property, missing cash from the register, anything like that. A loan or a debt, it really has to be an assigned document by the employee saying, I'm borrowing $500 and I agree to repay it under these terms, has to be very, very specific in order to be enforced. So I do see policies quite a bit from employers saying you don't get your final paycheck until you return your keys, and that's not permitted.
How about if somebody is in a manufacturing environment or maybe in an automotive environment and they have tools that they have on loan from an employer and they have signed an agreement that says I do not get my final paycheck until those tools are returned because they are company property?
Well, I think exactly the same rule applies. If it's in the nature of a loan of those tools, then the value of the tools should be set forth in the loan document signed by the employee along with an agreement for a repayment plan. So it has to be more specific than I don't get my final check, because that might be more than the value of the tools.
Well,
so I think, you know, you'd want to agree to the value and the way in which it would be repaid in the event they are not, or they're lost, or they're not returned at the end of the employment.
Would that apply for like a company phone or a company computer, laptop,
yes,
for example?
Yes, and if you don't have that kind of document, then the employer doesn't really have much recourse except to go through small claims court potentially, or maybe call the police to try and recover it. But that's a whole other issue.
And maybe another topic for another time. I want to thank you, Emery, for being on the show today. We've been talking about criminal issues in the workplace. If someone wants to get a hold of you, where can they go?
They can go to our website at rudmanwinchell.com and easily access my information and email address there.
Also, on the HR Power Hour website, right after the show today, we will have a link directly to Anne-Marie and her website. Anne-Marie, thank you very much. This has been a great topic, great information for employers today, and I appreciate you being on the show.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It was my pleasure.
And now the HR Tip of the Week, sponsored by Northern Insurance Group. Licensed agents in 28 states, business, commercial, and personal. Go to northerninsurancegroup.com. Today, our guest tip will be from Anne-Marie Story, and she's the employment attorney at Rudman & Winchell's. Anne-Marie, what's the tip of the week?
My tip of the week is for employers to be very careful about general policies that prohibit employees from talking about things that could constitute concerted activity under the NLRB, because those include things like talking about wages, criticizing supervisors, and even now, potentially the broad topic of gossiping. The Supreme Court's decision recently may be impacting decisions from the NLRB on this and other issues. It's still something employers should be very aware of and not to unlawfully prohibit.
And that's your HR Tip of the Week, sponsored by Northern Insurance Group at northerninsurancegroup.com. Next week on the HR Power Hour, we're going to have two great guests. First will be Susan Wasserat. She's the Director of Legislative Affairs and Rulemaking Liaison for the Maine Department of Labor, and she's going to be talking about her career and how she went from HR into the Department of Labor. It's going to be a great topic to understand how you can do more than just HR with an HR background. Then we're going to be talking with Dante Vespignani. He's a certified business coach with the Entrepreneur's Source, and he's going to be talking about making the decision to go from one position in terms of an organization into becoming your own boss or an entrepreneur. He's also going to be talking about franchising, and does it make sense for you to look at those for options? That's on the next HR Power Hour. Thank you for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 1310 a.m. or streaming live on WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at HRPowerHour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.